Hey, good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Winds of Change here at CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial, and we're heard all over the world on the internet at cfuv.uvic.ca. My name is Janine Bancroft. We are broadcasting from unceded Coast Salish Lekwungen territory here at the beautiful rabbit-free, unfortunately. I liked the rabbits. I kind of miss the rabbits. I know it's not their natural habitat and all that, but anyways, University of Victoria. And I first want to thank everybody who donated to the fund drive. As far as I know, we made our goal. People phoned sort of after the fact as well, and I know people are really good about honoring their commitments to support this station, so we're on the air for another year, and we got that new transmitter thanks to last year's fund drive, so we can look forward to another year of functioning equipment. Whoever spilled the crap on the telephone, I'm not really pleased with that. I don't know what goes on in here at night, but sometimes the morning shows get little surprises. Luckily, I was able to get through to our first guest, Jean McGuckin, and we'll be about the upcoming rally this weekend, cross-border rally on behalf of the unions. And, you know, we got to hang on to the unions, because otherwise we're all going to be working 7 days a week like I do, and not taking holidays and not getting paid a decent wage. I don't want everybody else in the world to be like that, for sure. Luckily, I love my work, so it's not so bad, and I need to form a union with myself for sure and get some better working conditions. Let's see. And then in the second half, very interesting guest also. Mickey Zed is in New York, where he's called Mickey Z, and he's an author and has often been a guest on Chris Cook's Guerrilla Radio Show. He's written a new book, which is called Darker Shade of Green. It's really a great book. And so we're going to be talking with Mickey in the second half. But with any luck, I have Jean. Did I get through to you all right, Jean? Are you there?
I am here. I am.
Oh, good. Yeah, I went to punch the keys on the phone, and they were like crusty. Yeah, so I had little moments of panic here with live radio, you know. But it's all never a dull moment. And same with you guys, looking at what's going on with the unions, I guess. These are pretty interesting times. Hey, now you're a retired paper worker, and you worked at a Burnaby recycling mill for 28 and more years. You're a member of the CEP. What's a CEP?
That's the Communications, Energy, and Paper Workers Union of Canada.
All right. And then you were a local president for 9 years. You were a chair of a bargaining committee for 5 years. You're the editor of the monthly newsletter for 22 years. I can imagine how much work that is. And then you were a co-founder in 2002 of the Prepare the General Strike Committee. We got so close to a general strike here, didn't we? What happened with that, Jean?
In 2004, I think you're talking about with the support for the hospital employees.
Right, who were
legislated back to work and had their contract, had their compensation slashed by 15%. Well, what happened there was the same thing that happened in Operation Solidarity, if people can cast their minds back that far, people who know about it, back in 1983, which is a handful of union leaders got together with the government in a back room and made a deal to call the whole thing off. And people were not given a... people on the picket lines and people who supported the people on the picket lines were not given any opportunity to have part in that discussion or any decision-making. And so they were all ordered to go back to work.
And that's kind of what happened in 2004 as well. So what's the disconnect there between the rank and file and the sort of... people are elected, I'm guessing, as in unions to be the decision-makers. Is that right?
Yes, they are elected, and well, there's different levels of unions, right? At their local union, you elect your immediate representatives. In some unions, that's true. The whole membership elects the regional or the national leadership. But in most cases, the regional and national leadership are elected by delegates at a convention. And so that's a very small percentage of the members. But, I mean, the major problem is that the members don't know a whole lot about what's going on, and a lot of them are interested in what's going on, so we get leaders that want to be leaders rather than the people that the members want to be leaders.
Right. So there could be some democratizing of the unions then, perhaps, somehow to get people more involved. So because they go to work and they pay their union dues and they get the benefits of the union, but they're not necessarily involved in... And I know people who work for unions and are just grumble about paying their union dues, right? They don't really get why they're doing that. Is that a problem too?
Well, it's a problem, and it's a problem from the bottom up and a problem from the top down. If the leaders led better, but if the members participated more, they would get more out of the union. If the leaders led better, they'd get more out of the union. It's the problem of democracy, as you said. How do you get people to engage and participate in running their own organization or, you write it larger, their own society?
Yeah, and I suppose it would be easier to participate if your employer encouraged that. And I suppose there are different types of employer relationships with unions as well. It seems like there's some rather good hostility going on. I've been following what's going on in Wisconsin. And are you from Wisconsin?
It's in, at one point I lived in Wisconsin, actually, just before I moved to Canada in 1970. I was a school teacher at a Catholic school in Wisconsin. And the reason I moved to Canada was because I got offered the all-expense station in Southeast Asia by the United States military, and I declined.
Good for you. Good for you. You're welcome here, all you folks. We're really happy to have you. And it's just too bad that the government's changed so that folks aren't quite so welcome now. And in fact, our own folks are overseas. I wonder where the Canadians are going to defect to. That's what I'm wondering. But so you probably know some of these people in Wisconsin then that are fighting the good fight there.
Well, that was 40 years ago, Janine. I don't know too many people in Wisconsin anymore.
I guess it is. It's 40 years ago. Holy crap, time goes by. So, okay, but you've been following what's going on. So for people who don't know what's going on, and I'm amazed how many people don't know what's going on in Wisconsin, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's going on in Wisconsin. The reason Wisconsin's getting all the focus isn't so much because of what the government is doing, because a number of state governments are doing similar things. But what's happening in Wisconsin is that the working people, and they've gotten support from shopkeepers and farmers and a number of other people, but basically the working people, the unionized working people, have fought back by, in the last month, spending weeks having a sort of nonstop demonstration at the state capitol building through snowfalls and through the evenings. They occupied the state capitol building and slept there for over 13 days. And they were, started off with like 30,000 people going to the demonstration, and the next day it was 50,000, and teachers were like calling in en masse and telling their employers they weren't going to work, they were going to this demonstration. And eventually built up to 100,000, and a couple of weeks ago, different people have different estimates, but a demonstration of up to 200,000 people took place in Wisconsin. So that's why it's gotten so much attention, although it's gotten attention not very well from the regular media, from the newspapers, the radio stations, and TV stations. The mainstream media have more or less ignored it. It's the clearest example of class-based journalism that I've seen in a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah,
anyway, they're fighting back, and they didn't stop. What they were fighting back against was in the Wisconsin's case, a bill called the Budget Repair Bill or something like that, that supposedly was to deal with the state financial difficulties that were blamed on the decent wages and benefits of the public sector workers. So this bill was going to deal with this financial situation by depriving the workers of all of their bargaining rights, their abilities to sit down and negotiate collective agreements, except for a small provision that allowed them to bargain wages up to the cost of living. But this and the bills that are similar to it in Michigan and Ohio and New Jersey, et cetera, ignore the fact that, A, in a lot of cases, the workers who were told that their wages and benefits were causing the problem, said, okay, well, we'll forego the wages and benefits. We'll make concessions on that. And the government said, oh, that's not good enough. We still want to take away your bargaining rights. And the other thing was that was ignored by the media, certainly, but also by the government, was the fact that in a lot of cases, and certainly this is true in Wisconsin, the new administration had only been, the new governor had only been in power since November, and between then and March, when, or in February, when he started attacking the unions, he'd already given a massive tax break to affluent people and corporations in Wisconsin. And that was what caused the financial difficulties, not the fact that the workers were making decent wages.
Right. Yeah, John Stewart's calling it the lamestream media, I realized last night. And certainly it was very exciting to watch on the alternative media on the internet and to see all of these people actually occupying the state capitol. And I mean, and police people among them, right? And fire people and teachers. And as you said, there was even a BCGU banner inside the building at one point.
Yes. There's a couple of people from the BCGU went down there and, in fact, the night the legislation was passed by a sneak move by the government, the government was forestalled from passing it because it had to go through the two chambers of the state legislature, the state assembly and the state senate. And it had no problem getting through the state assembly, but when it got to the state senate, there's a constitutional provision in Wisconsin that said that there had to be, for bills and civil matters, that there had to be a quorum of 20 senators present in the chamber to debate the bill. And the division in the chamber was that there were 19 Republicans, who were the people that were pushing this bill, and 14 or 13 Democrats. So they needed at least one Democrat there to make their quorum, and the Democrats all decided, the Democratic senators all decided that they would not show up to debate it. But they even went further than that because the state law would allow, the legislature's law would allow the Speaker of the Senate to call the members who were not present and force them to come, even by sending a state policeman after them to bring them back to escort them in. So the state senators all left the state and went to Illinois. So this crisis that could have been over in a few days, in fact, stretched out for a couple of 3 weeks, and that allowed the opposition to grow. And on the evening when they finally passed the bill, the Republicans said in a sneak meeting that they gave no notice of, barely gave any notice of, and they said that they'd stripped out the fiscal provisions and they just were going to pass the stuff that took away all the rights of the workers. There was a representative of the BC Government Employees Union in the state capitol during the demonstrations that resulted from that night. And in fact, I and my wife were texting with her back and forth while she was in the building telling us what was going on.
Cool.
It's quite exciting.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, and I mean, how sneaky is that, right? So they split the bill up so they could pass the part, and I understand it. They removed the money portion from it. So when they said it was about the money, it wasn't really about the money because they took that part out so that they could ram this thing through, right? And then now,
yeah.
Isn't it? It's before a court, and the court judge has declared. I forget what the ruling was.
Well, there's also another provision. Wisconsin has some amazingly democratic rules. For instance, one of them is that while this legislature or any body of the legislature or any committee of the legislature is in session, the state house has to be open to the public. That it is the people's house, and that was a slogan that was raised by a lot of the people. Whose house? Our house, the people's house. And another provision that says... I'm losing my train of thought here. Okay, well, the provision, I'm sorry, Janine,
that's okay.
Just completely
no worries.
Stirred me up again.
Well, we were talking about the court ruling and how they split the bill up, and that I was trying to remember what, you can tell we're getting older, right? Well, there's so many details. The court ruling is about the fact that there's
another provision in the state constitution that says if there's going to be a certain kind of meeting, like the one that they held to pass the bill, that they have to give a certain number of hours notice, and they didn't give that notice. So the court has, the county court, actually, in the county where the state capital is located, made a ruling that said that they didn't conform to this notice requirement, and therefore the bill was being put on hold. And I don't know exactly whether that's still the case, but it was a small hurdle. I mean, the government can get over it just by reintroducing the bill and giving the proper notice to the meeting.
Well, yeah, it holds it up for a while, and then I think that they came back and did something else, and then the judge said, "No, I'm, this is solid. Like, I really want to hold this bill up." So, well, it's certainly interesting to watch. And then there was some spillover into Ohio, I think, and I heard something about Florida. There's just so much information to keep track of in this world. But I'm wondering, we've got a few minutes left, but I'm wondering, what's the impact on Canadian unions, Jean? Are we seeing any similarities going on, they gutted the HEU. That was really, that was a few years ago. That was the BC Liberals. But what's gone on since then? Like, what's the state of unions in Canada now?
Well, you should ask. Just yesterday, the Ontario legislature passed a law stripping the Toronto transit workers of the right to strike because the government argues that it's an essential service, the transit system in Toronto is an essential service, and therefore the workers shouldn't have the right to strike. In British Columbia, I guess the most recent example we've had was when the emergency medical technicians a few months back were work to rule campaign because they hadn't had a contract for over a year, and the provincial government legislated their contract, and again on the basis that it was an essential service, which is, they might have had a slightly better argument that it was an essential service, but people should be aware that there are forces gathering to make this thing that's happening in the United States happen here. There was an editorial on March 3rd in the Toronto Sun saying that the public sector union is better wise up because they were too rich and asking for too much money and not caring about the taxpayers who had to pay for it and stuff like that. A couple of days later in the Financial Post, our old anti-union friends in the Fraser Institute here in Vancouver wrote a large article urging that Canadian governments copy the Wisconsin government and deprive public sector unions of the right to strike. And then just a few days ago, I ran into an article that was published in the Fredericton newspaper, Fredericton, New Brunswick newspaper, by a guy. Well, it was purported to be a news story, but it quoted an expert on New Brunswick public sector workers were living off the fat of the land, and that they were the taxes that were paying them were being paid by all these other workers who weren't making as much money as they were. And the expert that they were quoted on as saying that this was a growing problem was Herb Rubel, who was one of the founders of the Fraser Institute and a longtime anti-union activist and theorist. So this kind of thing is going to be coming to Canada, probably sooner rather than later.
Right. Well, the Koch brothers were they funded the Tea Party movement, and they also helped put Scott Walker in power. And yeah, I mean, these folks who are involved with the big corporations who don't pay their taxes, and the big banks who all got bailed out, and then now suddenly there's economic problems, and they got to take money away from the working people. And I really, what I don't get is, like, when we're all poor, I don't know how they expect the economy to happen when none of us have any money to spend. We've only got a couple of minutes left, Jean. I want to ask you just quickly, do you feel that the NDP are the representatives of the unions? I mean, they're sort of accused of that, and they're heralded as that, depending on how you feel about unions. Are they still representing the unions?
Well, not the full name. I understand she's not the leader anymore, but her position has been for a number of years that the NDP and the unions should be distant from each other. Surely she still wants the support of the unions, but she doesn't want to appear to be in the pocket of the unions. So, I think the unions, or at least the union leaderships, still look at the NDP as our party, as the workers' party. But I'm not sure that the way that the NDP acts when it's in government is always convincing of that.
Absolutely.
Anyway, because we just have a couple of minutes, I also wanted to say that anybody from your area that could possibly make it to this demonstration you mentioned at the beginning, this Saturday over at the Peace Arch Park, should do so. We're hoping to have several thousand people there. I would hope that it would be tens of thousands, but several thousand people there from British Columbia and the Washington and Oregon labor movements are also sending busloads of people to have a cross-border solidarity rally with the protesters in Wisconsin and the people in the other states that are fighting these battles.
Will there be rallies also in other places, or is this sort of something that we're just doing on this coast here?
It's, as far as I know, this is the only one that's being organized by the labor movement.
All right. Well, that's good. I mean, it's important that we talk to each other and figure out how we're going to deal with this future, the New World Order here. And, you know, the Peace Arch Park is so cool because you can sort of walk on both sides of the border without ever having to show your passport, right? So you can sort of flow a little bit. I mean, it's all fenced. You can't go too far, but it's kind of, it's good for gathering that way. So what's the deal on the buses going from Vancouver then?
There are buses going from Vancouver from the King George SkyTrain station at 12 and 12:30. The BC Fed has some, but you have to contact the BC Federation of Labor. And I don't have the email right with me right now, but if people go to the BC Federation of Labor website,
okay,
there's a quite clear section there in the upper left-hand corner that tells you how to make contact with buses. I do, however, want to say that it also, that website urges people when they go there that you should bring a passport, because it's true that a number of us have gone to demonstrations at the Peace Park where we've wafted back and forth across the border. But that was before the Homeland Security, through Age of Homeland Security, and nowadays they're saying that it's a good idea to have a passport or at least a government picture identification in your pocket if we're going to be wafting across the border, because border security officials could grab you and say, prove that you're a Canadian, prove that you're an American,
right,
or whatever.
Like Obama. Show your birth certificate. Right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Gene, for all that you do. I appreciate all your emails, and I don't get time to read all of them, but it's good to know somebody's watching what's going on. And so I would urge people to contact the BC Federation of Labor and head on over, and let's keep the unions alive and make them more democratic, too, and get people involved so that we don't all end up sending our kids into the coal mines again, because, you know, we like to put those days behind us. You have a great day, Gene.
Okay, you too, Janine.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that's Gene McGuckin from Vancouver, and the rally on Saturday at the border, at the Peace Arch. I'm going to phone Mickey Zed. I'm going to call him that because I'm Canadian and I can do that. And but I think he's probably prefers to be called Mickey Z. I got to play an ad and a little music and stuff like that. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes. So you're listening to CFUV 101.9 FM.
The Scottish Heritage and Cultural Societies of Victoria are pleased to announce their first annual National Tartan Day celebration, Saturday, April 2nd at the Market Square. Come down and see great entertainment with the whole family from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Festivities include the Greater Victoria Pipe Band, Highland Dancing, a kid's tent, Jim Brannigan, and much, much more. Celebrate Tartan Day, April 2nd at Market Square.
On the day we finally went outside, we dragged our knuckles into our eyes, and we covered up our cigarettes to strangers. The station wagon with the megaphone on top voided the contracts of traffic cops and our favorite TV shows projected on buildings.
And you are listening to the Winds of Change on CFUV-FM 101.9 Victoria. Seize the airwaves.
All right, and that was a group called Boats that we were listening to there, a song titled Sunrise on the Muffin District. And Boats are going to be in town here for a concert on Friday. They're going to be at a Teen Days, which CFUV 101.9 FM is presenting on Friday night, April 1st, at Felicitas here in the Student Union Building at the university. The doors open at 9. It costs $6. The Boats are going to be there. Also, Freak Heat Waves and Teen Days. So that sounds like a good thing to do if you're finished with your studies. What else do I have to do? Oh, I just have to announce there is a nice CRD walk this weekend. So the Capital Regional District has spring programs for nature lovers of all ages. So on Saturday from 1 till 3:30, you can go on a hike called Bear Hill Blooms. Bear Hill is in Saanich. And there's a naturalist who will be taking people on an up-close and personal look at some of the spectacular wildflowers of spring. Oh, good luck with that. It is so cold and windy here. It's just been a wacky spring. But there are some wildflowers starting to bloom, I noticed. But they're definitely later than they usually are. And I have Mickey on the line. And this is the part of the show where I usually talk about the weather. And we're really noticing the climate change. I bet you guys are too, hey, in New York?
Oh, yeah. But it's cold and damp today. And we had snow last week. And just before that, we had a sunny day of 75 degrees. We had all four seasons in 1 week.
Right, that's what's happening here, too. One day it'll be sunny and warm, and the next day it's freezing. You got to bundle all up. And, yeah, you guys had huge amounts of snow this winter, right?
Yeah. Way more than usual. Yeah, it was really intense.
It's scary, isn't it? Are people waking up to what's going on, Mickey, do you think?
I'd like to say yes, but people still buy into things like, well, how could it be global warming if there's this much snow? You know, there's just so much propaganda out there that it doesn't seem like it's sinking in any substantial way.
No, it's climate change, a climate crisis, I think, is the preferred terminology, I think. Excuse me. So I didn't really properly introduce you. Now I have a little froggy in my throat. I'm going to read from your book. It says this is a collective bio that was put together by some of your fans, I guess. I'm going to call you Mickey Zed. Can I call you Mickey Zed in Canada?
Sure.
Okay. It's the Roundhouse Kick of Activist Literature, profoundly mistrustful of government in all its dreadful guises, while courageously supporting all of us who stand against it. Determined to live the words rather than simply to speak them, Mickey Z, or Zed, doesn't get more readers. He just makes more friends. His blog is like a front stoop where we all gather to talk over the news, what's happening with each other, and generally enjoy each other's company. The gentle concern for his fellow humans and the behind-the-scenes acts of kindness are surpassed only by the cuteness of his dimples. That's really nice. And I love this book. And you are quite an author. You published your first book in 2000. And yes. How many have you written since then?
This novel, Darker Shade of Green, is the 11th.
Wow. And I have to tell you, I finished reading it this morning, and I wanted to start reading it again just so I could put all the pieces of it together in my head, you know, because it's a very circular piece, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of, out of the 11 books, 8 of them are nonfiction. So the 3 novels, in particular this one, give me a chance to sort of experiment a little bit more with format, and I'd like to think somewhat mimic the unpredictability of life a little bit more, and because very few stories and very few plot lines, whether they're fictional or nonfictional, are linear, and I have some fun when I do the fiction. So that's quite a compliment to me that you wanted to go back and start putting it together, because that's sort of what I had in mind.
Oh, great. Okay, good. I have an English degree, so I passed the test. That's great. and I mean, you brought up so many incredible things that are really concerns for me too, and I started making lists of them, you know, the whole cell phone thing and this, what's it called, columbite tantalite? Can you talk about that? Yeah. What's that about?
Well, the short name for that is Coltan, and it's something that I like when I do talks with a group of people. Most people say, I'm going to ask you all to turn off your cell phone, and I do the opposite, in which I ask them to leave it on, and I say, I do so because every time your phone rings, we can contemplate the Democratic Republic of the Congo, because one of the primary components of cell phone circuitry is this coltan that you talked about, which is primarily found in the African nation of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which is currently embroiled in a really brutal civil war by today's standards. And both sides in this war are funding their military mayhem by using child labor to mine and sell coltan, which then gets shipped to the West to feed our cell phone addictions. And then on top of that, the world's largest primate, the eastern lowland gorilla, has as its habitat the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And the gorillas that are located where the coltan are found, you can imagine what's being done to them. And in the past 5 years or so, the population of the world's largest primate has declined by 90%. So I point this out for many reasons, but one of the primary reasons is that so often we hear people say, well, first of all, because nobody even contemplates where their cell phone came from. But then if they do, they say, well, technology is neutral. It's only as good or bad as the uses. And I'd like to point out that technology, by definition, eats resources and is responsible for cycles like what I just described. And it really, really is time for us to start to connecting the dots before it's too late.
Yeah, and well, cell phones, and then the other end of the cell phone discussion is about the whole wireless thing, right? And the and the radiation that we're getting from the, and we really don't know the long-term implications of this technology.
In today's New York Times, which whenever the corporate media latches onto something, you realize that there must be something going on, because they probably found out about it 10 years ago. But in the New York Times today, they started to just touch on the studies that came out that are warranting, at the very least, concern about the huge amount of the huge increase in cell phone usage and the potential damages of electromagnetic radiation. And you can, just using the cell phone as sort of a launching part, because then you can get into the cell phone towers that are used and the damage and the amount of birds that are killed running into these towers. And I just found the cell phone as sort of an ideal, almost metaphor, to talk about our addiction to technology and our ignorance about what the costs of such technology are.
Right, and we just kind of buy it up, and it's fun and convenient, and you know, and we don't know the implications. And now, lest people think that your book is about cell phones, that's just a tiny, tiny little portion. I mean, snippets of information that want you to go to your internet and go, wow, I did not know about that. I better do some research. You talk about so many things in this book. But basically, the theme that runs through it is this kid who befriends a street guy from New York. Now, is the street guy Alphonse Romano? Is that modeled on a real person, or is that...
No, interestingly, this particular character was... I created Ali Romano as far back as 1989, believe it or not. And originally he had an entire film script called Ali Romano. And then he kind of got put aside, and I just liked the concept. Let me just explain who... Ali is a homeless man in New York City who challenges the common perceptions of what people believe about homelessness, because he's extremely intelligent and perceptive and touches very deeply the lives of the people that he interacts with. And in fact, for lack of a better example, he's sort of like a human search engine. He sort of knows a little bit about everything. And I became fascinated by this concept that someone that interesting and that wise could be someone that New Yorkers are just stepping over in the street and looking down their nose and look at that guy, he refuses to work, and so on. And so he stayed in my consciousness for a long time. He makes an appearance in each of my first two novels, CPR for Dummies and Dear Vito. It's like sort of a cameo appearance. And finally, in Darker Shade of Green, he was able to fully come to life and become one of the primary two characters in the book. And so I'm really excited that Ali Romano is reaching the public.
I am too. And, you know, I mean, there are street people who are this wise, and people do step over them and don't realize what's going on. And, he challenges us to think about everything almost in society that we, you know, we watch, people watch the news and just sort of go, oh, yeah, that's what's going on, and accept it. And then your book invites people to say, well, why do we accept that this is normal? You know, why do we call this? You know what it reminded me of, Mickey? One time I had some magic mushrooms. They grow around here, you know, and with some friends, and we were by the beach, and we were with nature, and it was so beautiful, you know, and then we came up out of the wilderness and into the city, and I had this moment of, oh, like, this is crazy, this city thing. You know, and reading your book, it kind of made me think about that. Like, there's so much we sort of take for granted, and until somebody says, "Well, why do you think that's normal? Go."
And I think that having the character be someone who's so much on the fringes of society, might even be called by our society an unproductive member, allows that character to have a certain freedom of vision that those locked into the system might not allow themselves to even have, even if they have doubts about the way things are going and why things are a certain way and why something's considered normal and why something isn't. If you have either voluntarily or involuntarily been dumped from the system, it may, and in the case of this fictional character, it did, allow him to have a perspective that many of us don't have, because we're caught up in this high-speed daily race to produce and survive, and, you know, dealing with debts and profits and basically everything that makes up a capitalist society. And I thought that was sort of like the sense of irony that this man, by dropping out in a way that is generally looked as the worst-case scenario for people, you know, oh, be careful, you'll wind up homeless. But he dropped out in that way, and it gave him a greater vision and a broader perspective on our culture. And then he gets to share it with this 12-year-old boy who's run away and spend some time with him and influence him in such a way, because the story's told in a flashback since the boy's grown up now. And this boy becomes, you know, quite a potentially a very important character.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what happens, isn't it? When we're young and we can talk, have these sorts of conversations and realize, you know, yeah, war is really weird. Why do we call it okay to murder people overseas, but, you know, and then let other things happen that people get, you know, punished for? Why do they get punished for it here and not there, sort of thing? Stuff like that. And then something happens after we grow up and we become part of the system and we're not encouraged to ask those questions anymore, and so the kid is, does he have an, yeah, JT is his name, right? And he invites us to revisit those questions that we had when we were kids and wonder, you know, where did we lose ourselves, perhaps. I liked this one. Now, the Internet Insurgent, this is why I need to reread it, because I'm not sure if that's the same characters or if that's just sort of added in, but I like the part where you say, embrace not the corporate sanctioned standard American diet. Go vegan, organic, and local. Be warned, what you own ends up owning you. Say no to conspicuous consumption. And it goes on from there. We don't want to give too much of the book away, but I want to talk about being vegan. How long have you been vegan for?
Going on 16 years now.
Wow, good for you. Yeah. And were you veggie before that?
No, actually, my wife Michelle and I, we went very, very briefly vegetarian as we learned more information and quickly transitioned into veganism because, like a lot of people, the last holdout might be cheese or something. But we were just gathering information and listening to supported radio here in New York, WBAI. They had a lot of shows with information. And it just came fast and furious, and our transition, in retrospect, I look at it now, was actually kind of rapid, but enduring at this point, you know, 16 years. It's not a phase, but it's something, it's one of the best decisions I've ever made.
Yeah, doesn't it feel good? I'm going on 11 years, and I've never
awesome.
Felt healthier and just more clear in my head. You know, I think a lot of energy is put into justifying what we put into our bodies, whether it's conscious or subconscious. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so when you're vegan, you don't have to go through that whole rigmarole in your head about why you have a right to eat this crap. So I do appreciate that perspective for sure. Is there a growing vegan movement in New York City? I guess it's one of the cities.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. This, just for example, this Sunday coming up is a large vegetarian food fest, and every year they have what they call the Veggie Pride Parade, which is modeled on the Gay Pride Parade. Last year I was the keynote speaker. I was fortunate enough to do that. And they start the parade down in the old, what used to be called the Meat District, the Meat Market District in New York City. And so it's kind of ironic that they picked that, and they marched to the famous Union Square Park, where 100-plus years ago Emma Goldman was rabble-rousing. To stand up on a platform in Union Square and give a rabble-rousing speech was a great moment, because I felt like I could hear the echoes of all the rebels that spoke there over the past century or so. And definitely, I mean, there's more and more restaurants and more gatherings. And the Internet has helped, of course, with meetup groups and so on. But I definitely have seen a huge, huge change in the vegan community over the 16 years that I've been vegan. Change for the positive.
That's awesome. And raw vegan, too, right?
I'm sorry?
The raw vegan movement?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. It seems like New York would be as easy a city as there is in America to be both vegan and raw in terms of accessibility to food and accessibility to comrades that you can brainstorm with and ask questions and share ideas. So it's really, really a great place to go, raw and vegan.
Well, and I have a friend, and I don't know if he's listening, he probably isn't, but he's opening a bagel bakery in San Francisco. He had a very successful go of it in Seattle years ago, and he's reinventing the bagel bakery in San Francisco, and I'm doing everything I can to convince him that vegan, especially in San Francisco. And my point is that as vegans, if there's like a restaurant that has, you know, vegan options next to a restaurant that has vegan, is exclusively vegan, we're going to go to the exclusive place, right?
Sure.
Because then you know that your food isn't going to get contaminated and you know what's going on in the kitchen and that sort of thing. And I think my friend is trying to sort of please everybody. And I think that as the vegan movement progresses, you know, more and more, we're just going to stay away from those places that aren't completely vegan because we can go to places that are completely vegan. Do you kind of agree with that?
Yeah, and as I said, New York is wonderful for that. You certainly have an incredible amount of restaurants that will have vegan options, and over the 16 years I've been vegan, the transition of having waiters and waitresses understand what that means.
Right.
So it's excellent. But there's so many exclusively vegan establishments in New York that you don't have to necessarily go to the places that just offer vegan options and all the potential downfalls of that. And I think people eventually will, like you said, that the potential restaurant owners and grocery store owners and so on will begin to recognize this trend. And hopefully there'll be more and more of vegan and with including organic and local components to them.
Right, that's important too, the organic and local. And I think people who aren't vegan they just kind of don't get that. So I'm just, you know, trying to encourage my friend because the future is going to be vegan. I think if we're going to survive on this planet, that's one of the really most powerful things we can do. So, okay, so you agree with that? Yeah?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so getting back to your book, I wanted to read a little bit out of page 59. I love this page, where JT asks Alphonse, why do you do this instead of working and getting married and all that? Do you have the book in front of you? Maybe you could read it.
I'm sorry?
Do you have the book in front of you?
I can do that right now.
Can you do that? On page 59. So this is this 12-year-old kid who's run away from home, and he lives in an affluent home, and he's decided he's quite enamored with this, with Alphonse.
He says 59?
59, yeah. So where he says, you know, because that's the standard question, like the get a job thing, right? And, you know, I mean, there's so many answers to that, but I kind of like Alphonse's response there.
I'm bringing it up on a document.
Oh, okay. How long? So, all right. So you've been working on this for years and years, and it's going to be available soon. It's not quite available yet.
Well, it's available for pre-order, and if people go to MickeyZ.net, there's a link there that they can find to do that.
So Mickey,
place the order now.
Okay, Mickey, and then the last letter of the alphabet, .net.
Yeah, no, it's dead. It's with Z down here instead of there. Okay. You know what? The document is not going to match what you're...
Oh.
I'm going to just let you read it because I don't want to hold you up.
Oh.
You read it and then I can comment on it.
Okay. This country is built on the principle of maintaining the proverbial status quo, he began. A vast, comprehensive, and inhuman system has been implemented to ward off challenges to this status quo. Acceptance of this ever-growing system has slowly become an almost inbred characteristic of Americans. Hence, even hinting at chinks in the armor is greeted with vehement resistance, even from the misguided oppressed themselves. The fervor of this resistance is tantamount to self-defense. For years, I've heard people question my sanity after hearing my thoughts on the system. They wonder if I really believe this to be true. It hardly matters. The system exists with or without our belief. I've chosen to see it for what it is. Perhaps I'd be wiser to simply conform, but my mind will not let. Comment.
Yeah. Obviously I felt very strongly about those words because I look around and perhaps the most frightening, you know, we could point out so many different aspects. I just was reading an article about the disappearing bees, and we could talk about 80% of the world's forests being gone and 90% of the large fish in the ocean being gone. But perhaps the most frightening aspect of this entire inhumane system is the system of propaganda that either obscures these realities or obscures the human role in these realities or somehow creates a way that the humans will defend such a system. Perhaps an example of that more recently would be what they call the Tea Partiers in America, where they seem to be attacking comrades as opposed to the corporate structure that's creating an incredibly unequal society and the destruction of our ecosystem. And as you were reading them, it was great to hear someone else read it because it's those are words that I felt were really important because, as you mentioned earlier, and it was a really crucial connection, Ali, as a homeless person, stepped out of the society and it allowed him to have perhaps even a fresh view of this society. And that's why, in a way, he could interact and connect with the 12-year-old because, as you said, the 12-year-old hadn't been completely inculcated into the educational system and the profit-based system. And so suddenly they could both look at the world with a sense of without blinders on. And I think that so for a 12-year-old then to ask this man, who's clearly an interesting man, a man that he admires, well, why do you do this? It was important to explain to this child the level of what this system is made of and that it's how important it is to create a culture of resistance against this and how crucial and how urgent it is also. And that's ultimately, I would hope, would be the message of the book, is that we live in perhaps the best time ever to be an activist because I don't know if things have ever been worse. So that means there's so much to do. No matter where your passions lie, there is so much to do, and it's just a matter of waking up and recognizing what's going on, B, accepting the human role in what's going on, and then C, finding steps to take, and not just switching to recycled toilet paper or signing a petition, but it's time to start considering much more drastic steps in order to save the the only ecosystem we have.
What, like what? What would you suggest? Beyond shifting your whole lifestyle, so, you know, sell your car, go vegan. What else? How can we get these corporate guys? What do we do with the corporations? That's the mind-boggling part to me.
Well, I mean, the question actually points out in a way why this book ultimately, why this message ultimately got shared by me in a fictionalized book, because the system is aware of the destruction that it breeds. It also becomes extremely oppressive.
It profits off the destruction it creates.
Yeah, yeah, and as we get closer and closer to this brink of environmental, economic, and social collapse, the system responsible for it will then become more and more and more oppressive, in the sense that it's realizing that everything is sliding through its greedy fingers. So what it's created, at least here in the U.S., is this culture of fear to speak out about anything more than marching in a protest. So what I encourage people to do, and a part of the book is the group that's inspired by Ali Romano, that they call themselves the Pawns. They have a little handbook that's broken down into 5 chapters, and the chapters how to be a good organizer, how to find comrades, how to plan a protest. And the general concept in there is that the Ali-inspired advice is to consider the incredible depth of the crisis that we're in and then take the appropriate action.
Right, and that's the point.
Because we know what to do. I remember just the most recent talk that I gave here in New York, and we were talking about how some people are afraid to be, to be so different or to be considered righteous or to be considered rude. And I said, well, if a fire broke out in the corner of the room, would the person closest to the fire be worried if they had to interrupt me and be rude to inform the room that the bookstore was on fire? And I think we need to start treating this with that level of urgency. And then, therefore, you say to yourself, what would I do? And the answer is whatever is necessary. And right, whatever that means to you, then you do it.
All right. And that was the Pawns, not the Pawns. You have that great New York accent. So the Pawns, like at chess, because chess is a major theme in the story,
yeah,
as well. All right. So Darker Shade of Green, and people can access that at mickeyz.net, right? Right.
Yes. The current post that's up there on my blog has a direct link to Raw Dog Screaming Press. It's an excellent publishers. I just published 2 of my novels, and the deepest appreciation for them. And I really, really hope that people will order the book and check it out, and they can contact me via the blog or find me on Facebook, and I'd love to interact and hear some thoughts.
Right. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mickey. And if I ever get to New York, I hope that we can have a vegan lunch somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. Indeed, thank you for having me on and for all the support and all the great work that you do. It's great to speak with a comrade, and it was a lot of fun to be on the show.
Yeah, and you too. All right, you take care, Mickey.
Talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that was Mickey Z or Zed from New York City, and I really recommend this book, mickeyz.net. The book is called The Darker Shade of Green, or all his other books. I haven't actually read his other books. I think they're around. I think Chris Cook has got a hold of a couple of them, and interviewed Mickey on his show, Guerrilla Radio, Mondays at 5:00. So, and I know he donates his books usually to Viper or Camus, so they're floating around here somewhere. We've just got a couple of minutes left. I want to again invite the university students to the Felicitas party on April 1st. If people aren't going to the April 1st party at Felicitas, that's sponsored in part by CFUV. The Street News is also having a party, and our little party is in a coffee shop, so it's just downtown from 7:30 till 9:30. In fact, you can go to both. And we're going to be at the Solstice. We're 7 years old on the 1st, and so we're going to celebrate. We've never celebrated, and I guess we better do it now. We might not make it till 10, so depending what goes on with Japan and all the rest of it. So that's it. So I'm going to play a little more music from a band called Teen Days, who are the feature on Friday at, or sorry, yeah, Friday at Felicitas. And that's all. Invite you to stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up next, also from New York City. And this is CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial. And we're heard all around the world on the internet at cfuv.uvic.ca. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. This time slot next week will be Each for All, the Cooperative Connection. Have a great day and look out for each other.